It was chance, an intervention of fate, which led Panther Comax to get his homebound convoy on the road when he did, because in early November, Federal troops launched a determined invasion that captured Brownsville, thus terminating the Matamoras-Baghdad trade. To prove that they meant business, the troops also ranged inland at isolated spots, attacking any southbound convoys and burning the cotton, or bursting the bales and scattering it across the landscape until snow seemed to be falling on the brushy plains. One evening, such a foraging party came upon Comax and his stragglers. Panther shouted to the slaves and the boys, "Run! Hide!" But when he and his men turned back to fight off the attackers, a sudden fusillade of Union bullets ended his violent life. Major Somerset Cobb did not return to Lammermoor until after Lee's surrender at Appomattox. Then, his left arm gone, his weight not more than 120, he came up the Red River from the hospital at New Orleans with the doctor's benediction. "God must have saved you, Cobb. We did damned little." At Shreveport he was pleased to see that the great raft was still in place, and his heart expanded, and he felt something close to joy when the limping steamer, one boiler gone, edged into Lake Caddo, and he saw once more the knobby cypresses and the Spanish moss hanging in lovely festoons from the live oaks that crowded the shore. As always, the steamer sounded its whistle as it approached Lammermoor, and he saw with fresh pleasure that slaves aboard the craft were preparing to unload at that wharf called the Ace of Hearts. With pulsating enthusiasm, he explained to a first-time passenger, "Our slaves can't read, you know. We mark shipments, spades, or clubs, showing where parcels go. We're Ace of Hearts." The little vessel docked, and the pain of return took command. He saw fields rotten with weeds, buildings unpainted. But the mill still stood, and here came Trajan, best slave a man ever had. Cobb leaped ashore, his empty left coat sleeve pinned up, and embraced him. "It's good to be home, Trajan. Been a long war, master." Slowly, Forsett was very tired. They walked up the slope toward his house. And now a small, fearfully thin woman came to greet him. It was Petty Prue, much smaller than he remembered, much more worn by the last years of war than he could have imagined. Reaching for his one hand, she said, "It was always stupid to have two plantations here. I have joined them, Set." She had joined not only the land, but also their lives. On the 23rd of June, 1865, there was great excitement in Jefferson, for a Union captain attended by 14 soldiers marched in, ordered a bugle to be sounded, and informed the white citizens who assembled, "I am here to address your former slaves, too. Call them." Stiffly he waited till the latter were gathered, then signaled for another blast on the bugle. A sergeant shouted, "Silence!" and the fateful words were spoken. Citizens of Jefferson, on the 19th of June instant, General Gordon Granger of the United States Army issued at his headquarters in Galveston General Orders No. 3. All slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality between former masters and their slaves. The new connection between white and black is that of employer and hired workman. Here he turned specifically to the Negroes. You freedmen are advised to stay at your present homes and work for wages. You are informed, and most strongly, that you will not be allowed to collect at military posts, and you will not be supported in idleness. You must find work to do, and it would be best if you continue to work for wages at your present jobs. The captain stepped back, pleased with the impression he had made, then signaled his sergeant, who cried, "Former slaves, you are free." There was a rustle, more of confusion than of comment. "Slaves, you are no longer slaves," the captain said. "You are as free as I am, or..." He looked about for some white person, spotted Cobb, and pointed at him. "As free as this man." An old slave in the front rank fell to his knees, raised his hands over his head, and shouted in a feeble voice, I lived to see it. Praise God Almighty, I lived to see it. When the reality of what had been announced struck home, there was no wild outcry, no jubilant dancing in the square. And white men were surprised that the former slaves took word of their freedom with such composure. But there were scenes which epitomized that crucial day in Jefferson history. One black woman, obedient to impulses no one could later explain, grabbed her 7-year-old boy and shook him violently, shouting at him, "You ain't no more slave. Now will you mind?" And she wept. Major Cobb had come to the meeting anticipating what might happen, and he moved among his former slaves, assuring them that what the stranger said was true. "Yes, you're free." But his attempt at conciliation failed when Big Matthew ran up to him, shook a fist in his face, and shouted, "Don't work for you no more." When a laundry woman asked Matthew, "What I do with your clothes?" he roared, "Burn 'em." And again he shook his fist at Cobb. "Don't work for you no more. Don't work for your bitch no more." Instinctively, Cobb raised his right arm, but a Union soldier prevented any further action. The meaning of true emancipation, not President Lincoln's false gesture of some years before, was brought home to Lammermoor the next afternoon, when amidst the clamor about freedom, Trajan appeared at the mansion, a place he had rarely entered, knocked politely at the door, and asked to see the master. Standing respectfully, he said, "Major Cobb, you got the plantation under control. I's leavin'." "What?" The statement was like the explosion of a bomb. "I wants a place of my own. I got no more taste for living in slave quarters here at Lammermoor." "But you helped build this place. You're part of it." "Always I builds for someone else. Now I wants to work for myself." Cobb called for his wife, and when Pettiprue heard of the former slave's unexpected announcement, she echoed Seth's reaction. "Haven't we always treated you decently?" Trajan would not be sidetracked by any discussion of past conditions. Standing very erect, as he had been taught to do when reporting to a master, he said, "I come home from Mexico 2 years ago. Money I earned swim in the river." When he saw incomprehension on the faces of the Cobbs, he produced the paper signed by Johnson Carver during those days of high adventure with the two boys. And there in the silent room, when he thought of those daring lads, so like his son, he hung his head, and the terrible grief of this war and these tangled years overcame him. He could not present his case, and the Cobbs let him go, thinking that emancipation had unsettled him. Next day, Major Cobb and his wife invited their former slave to meet with them in the same room, and this time they asked him to sit down. "Trajan, we suppose that with your money, and congratulations on having so much, I know many white families who would..." Pettiprue, suddenly the more masterful of the Cobbs, broke in. "Don't spend your money on land. You've been so faithful, and we appreciate you so profoundly..." She choked, and seemed not so masterful after all. "What we propose," her husband said, "is to give you 5 acres of your own, that land against the oak trees." Trajan rose. "All these years I got my eye on a nice strip of land, edge of Jefferson. Last night I bought it." "A slave buying land?" The words had slipped away from Pettiprue, who was immediately sorry she had said them. "I bought it. I paid dollars, and I'm leaving this morning, and your maid Pansy wants to go with me." "But Trajan," Pettiprue cried in real confusion, "you were so wonderful helping me, taking that cotton down to Mexico and coming back home." She looked at him in near despair. "We thought you liked it here." Trajan moved to the door, determined not to be swayed by any argument these good people might advance. With tall dignity he told them, "You can say I was faithful, because I was, And you can say I come back when I could have run away, because I did. And you can say I was respectful, because I liked the way you handled this plantation with the men gone, Miss Prue. I tried to be a good slave, but don't never say I liked it. And he was gone. Not long after, Major Cobb and his new bride entered their carriage, old now and needing refurbishing, and rode into Jefferson, where on the edge of town they found the small cottage for which their former slave Trajan had paid $22.50, including an acre of land. The spring flowers were fading, but the Cobbs could see where the summer beauties would soon be peeking out. "We've come to make you a proposition, Trajan." "I've been expecting you." "How so?" Pettiprue asked, accepting the chair her former maid Pansy offered. The others would stand, for there was only the one. "Because you need me. You're going to need me bad to run your gin, your mills." "You're right," Cobb said. "We do need you." "We miss you," Pettiprue said, "and we trust you." "What I'd be willing to do," Cobb said enthusiastically, "is buy this house from you, give you the land I spoke of, and you could—" "This is my house," Trajan said. "Pansy and I, we live here. You want us to work for you? We walk to work. But when work's over, we come back here." He said this so forcefully that the Cobbs were stunned. They could not imagine that a black man would surrender such an obvious financial advantage in defense of a principle. There was silence, broken by a practical suggestion from the major. "We'll give you a mule so that you can ride to the mill." "I would like that," Trajan said. Then he added a suggestion of his own. "To run the mill right, we ought to have Big Matthew back." Cobb noticed Trajan's use of "we," as if he were once more in charge of things. But the suggestion that Big Matthew be forgiven for his intemperate behavior was too much. "No," Cobb said gravely, "Matthew tried to strike me, and that I cannot forgive." "Don't you think he got a lot to forgive?" Cobb studied this sensible question for some moments, then asked, "Will he work?" "He ain't been working, and he ain't been eatin'. Big Matthew, he ain't dumb." When Cobb reluctantly agreed to hire the big man, Trajan brought forth a most unexpected request. "Major Cobb, Miss Prue, I knowed you would be comin', and I knowed what you was goin' to propose this mornin', and I knowed I would accept, because I loves Lammermoor. But I had to jump the gun a little." "You borrowed money?" "No," he broke into an easy laugh. "Smart man like me don't throw money around. I still got all but what I paid for the land." "What then?" "Union officers been houndin' us, in a nice way, but they say all us former slaves got to take last names. They come to me yesterday, very forceful. This is the one they give me." He hesitated. "At my suggestion, if you ain't mad." He presented the Cobbs with a card bearing his new name, Trajan Cobb. And Pettiprue said, "We welcome you to freedom." Task Force. The Washington Insider almost wrecked our two-day May meeting, in which we were to discuss the effect on Texas history of Southern immigration from states like Georgia and Alabama. 3 days prior to our session, the magazine revealed in a long think piece the secret deliberations of a committee that had been assigned the task of selecting a new director of the Smithsonian Institution. The names of the four finalists were disclosed not in alphabetical order, but according to their position in the betting. And the committee was astonished to find my name given last, but with the notation, "May be the dark horse, apparent favorite of the board's intellectuals." Before we could open our meeting in Dallas, a pulsating city whose vitality excited me, members of the press wanted to interview me, and when they were through, our own committee took over. "It's a big job," I said, but immediately I corrected my phrasing. "Make that, it would be a big job for whoever gets it." "What are your chances?" Rusk asked, cutting as usual to the crucial question. "You saw the story. Last in line, but still fighting. Do you want it? Anyone like me would want it, Ransom. Best job of its kind in the nation. But my chances... He cut me off, asked for a phone, and within 8 minutes had spoken to his Texas friends serving in Congress, telling them, not asking, to get on the ball and see that I got the appointment. He put in a special call to Jim Wright, the representative from Fort Worth, majority whip in the House, asking him for special help. Much of our first day was wasted in aimless discussion about the possibility of my going to Washington. But the situation was placed in its proper perspective by the arrival in the late afternoon of a senior editor from The Insider, who asked to have cocktails with us, and who divulged in the course of our chatting the actual situation. I hate to say this, Barlow, but I have reason to believe that the selection committee threw your name in the hopper only to avoid the charge of parochialism. Most of the leading candidates were from the Northern and California establishments, and they wanted the news stories to carry at least one Southern or Western name, and you covered both Texas and Colorado, to provide a respectable balance. Wait a minute, Rusk protested, with that automatic defense of Texas which made men like him so abrasive. You don't use a Texan for window dressing. Damn it, we'll soon be the most powerful state in the Union. But the University of Texas? A national committee would never... Now Quimper broke in to defend the school on whose board of regents he sat. Our university takes a back seat to no one. In academic circles it does. That miserable show you people put on some years back, that Regent Quimper going around firing everyone he didn't like. That was my father, Quimper exploded. And you're right. Some people condemned him as a meddler. Those who knew him considered him a genius. At any rate, Texas now has 2 first-class public institutions. Which 2? The visitor asked. And I was astonished by Quimper's answer. Texas and A&M. Often at our meetings he had joked about the latter school, denigrating it horribly. But now he was defending it. The difference was that when he joked, he was doing so to fellow Texans. When an outsider presumed to criticize, he became defensive. They're decent schools, the Washington man conceded, of the second category. What the hell are you saying? Quimper asked, his face growing red and his pronunciation more Texan. The university has Steven Weinberg, Nobel winner, and A&M has just signed up the great Norman Borlaug, also a Nobel winner for his work on grains. Yes, our visitor concluded. But you hire them long after they've done their best work elsewhere. It's doubtful you'll ever produce a Nobel winner of your own. You Washington know-it-alls make me puke, Quimper said, retiring from the conversation. But the rest of us accepted the challenge, and in a series of short, impassioned statements, we defended the intellectual honor of our state. Miss Cobb was most effective. You must remember, young man, that power is flowing into Texas at an astonishing rate. More congressmen with every census, more industry, more of whatever it is that makes America tick. You unfortunate people in the North will be spending the rest of your lives dancing to a Texas tune. You should accustom yourselves to it. There are rules of quality which cannot be evaded, the editor, a graduate of Amherst and Yale, said. Texas will have the raw power, yes, but never the intellectual leadership. You'll always have to depend on the areas and the schools with higher standards. That's the sheerest nonsense I've heard in a long time, Rusk grumbled. In the fields that matter these days, Texas is already preeminent, and will stay that way. What fields? The Washington man asked. And Rusk ticked them off. Petroleum, aviation, silicon chips... Population growth. When your oil wells dry up, the editor said, you become another Arizona, colorful but of little relative significance. Rusk leaned back and looked at the young expert. Son, of 100 units of oil in the ground in 1900, take any well, any field you want. How much do you suppose we've been able to pump out so far? Go ahead, guess if you're the last word on petroleum. What, 70% taken out, 30% still underground? We've taken out 20%. The limitations of present techniques prevent us from taking any more. So 80% of Texas oil, and that's a monstrous reservoir, is still hiding down there, waiting for some genius to invent a better pump, a better system of bringing it up to where we need it. And you can be sure we'll invent some way of doing just that. Now, Quimper snapped back. And the man who figures it out is going to get his own Nobel Prize. Since the discussion had centered on me originally, I felt obligated to make a contribution. I wanted the Smithsonian job, anyone would, to shepherd the material record of the nation. But, in a way, these two men are right. That's a museum job, the past. The great struggles of the future are going to be fought out here in Texas, even more than in California. The young man had excited our minds so thoroughly that Russ suggested, "Some of the things you say make a lot of sense. Have dinner with us." During the meal, the visitor made 2 points which kept the pot of agitation bubbling. Texas will accrue power, that's obvious, but 2 deficiencies will hold you back. Because you produce no national newspaper like the New York Times or the Washington Post, you'll not command serious intellectual attention. Newsweek losing its Texas editor, that hurts the opportunities of other Texans like Marlowe enormously. Before either Russ or Quimper could leap to defend the young man who had left Newsweek, the editor made a humorous evaluation which ignited the basic fires of patriotism. "And because your diet is so very heavy and unimaginative, you'll lose ground to California, which eats so sensibly." This was too much for Quimper. A good chicken-fried steak smothered in white gravy, or a big slab of barbecue with baked beans and potato salad, that's man's food. That keeps the blood circulating. And the cholesterol raging. "I wouldn't be surprised," Quimper said, "if quiche and endive salad don't destroy California, granting it's still there after the earthquake hits." As the night wore on, Professor Garza asked seriously, "So what are the chances that our boy will land the Smithsonian job?" And our visitor said, "Non-existent. They'll have to have someone with more prestige and from a more acceptable locale. But even listing Barlow was a vote of confidence. 20 more years, if things progress as Miss Cobb suggests, someone from Texas will be acceptable." "At that point," Rusk said firmly, "we'll be sending our young people to see Washington and New York the way we send them now to see Antwerp and Milan. Interesting historical echoes, but no longer in the mainstream." When we convened in the morning, we found that our staff had provided us with a professor from Texas Christian University who offered a genteel antidote to the heated argument of the night before. "I must warn you right at the start that I'm a Georgia woman who did her graduate work at South Carolina, so I'm imbued with things Southern, and the more deeply I dig into our past, the more respect I feel for Southern tradition. So please bear with me as I parade my prejudices." She delivered one of those papers that flowed along amiably, making subtle points whose veracity became self-evident as she marshaled her data. If the insider man had dealt with the turbulent future, she led us seductively into a gallant past. When I was a student, Southern professors made it a point to avoid what they called that unfortunate phrase, the Civil War. They claimed it was never a civil war. They said that implied that in a state like Virginia, half the families sided with the North and took arms to defend that cause, while the other half favored the South and fought for it, with blood from 2 members of a given family mingling as it ran down some country lane in Virginia. They argued that that did not happen, not even in fractured states like Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri. "No," they said with great emotion, "this was a war between states, Massachusetts versus Alabama. And when those Missourians who did favor the North fought their fellow Missourians who sided with the South, they did so at outside places like Vicksburg and Shiloh, never in Missouri itself. For them, it was a war between sovereign states, and in our papers we had to refer to it as such. But now, for historians South and North, it's the Civil War." Having instructed us on that important point, she proceeded to the heart of her statement. While I find it impossible to describe Texas as a true Southern state, I do not ignore the profound influence that Southern mores have exerted. In 1836, Texas had principally a Northern caste, as installed by people from Connecticut and Ohio who had laid over in Kentucky and Tennessee. But within the next 25 years, say to 1861, the influence of the South became overwhelming. The vote on secession, interrupted Rusk, who was always surprising us with his command of relevant data, was more than 3-1, 46,000 to 14,000, in favor of quitting the Union and fighting on the side of the South. Far more important was the cultural domination. The few Texas children who had school teachers tended to have Southern ones. Children able to go away to college often went to Southern ones. Books by Southern authors were purchased from Southern stores. Southern newspapers were read. Turning to Garza, she said, "You won't like this, Professor, but recent studies are beginning to suggest that the Texas cowboy derived not primarily from Mexican prototypes, but from the habits of drovers coming in from the Southern states." She cited a score of challenging statistics and illustrations showing that the impact of the South on Texas custom was pervasive. But as so often happens in such discussion, three of her almost trivial observations aroused far more interest than those of a graver nature. Food. Here the traditions of the South dominated. The Texans' love of okra, for example. One of the world's great vegetables, not native to Texas and unknown in states to the north, but a staple in the South. One could claim that the finest contribution we made to Texas life was the introduction of okra. Cornbread the same. Iced tea, which is practically the national drink of Texas, especially with a touch of mint or lemon. And I'm particularly fond, as many Texans are, of dirty rice. "What's that?" Garza asked, and the lecturer looked at him as if he were deprived. "You don't know that gorgeous dish? Rice steamed in bouillon, with chicken giblets and chopped onions and pepper? Professor Garza, you ain't lived." Her second point was more serious. The most lasting influence may have been the language. The famed Texas drawl is nothing but the Deep South lingo moved west. You never say business, it's bidness. And I am very partial to the dropping of the S in words like isn't and wasn't. Isn't today glorious and wasn't yesterday a bore? It was her third assertion which generated most comment. "I sometimes think that the major importation from the South was a sense of chivalry, a dreamlike attitude toward women. The men coming west really had read their Walter Scott. They did see themselves as avatars of the heroic age. They lived on the convive, always ready for a duel if their honor was in any way impugned. They had exaggerated interpretations of loyalty and were ready to lay down their lives in obedience to those beliefs. Passionately devoted to freedom, they sacrificed all to preserve it. And, like champions of old, they were not afraid to defend losing causes." Texas today is Carolina of yesterday, and in no aspect of life is this more apparent than in your attitude toward women. You cherished us, honored us, protected us, but you also wanted us to stay to hell in our place. In no state of the Union does a woman enjoy a higher social status than in Texas. She is really revered. But in few states does she enjoy more limited freedoms. If I were, and God should be so generous, 19 years old, with an 18-inch waist, flawless skin, and flashing green eyes, I'd rather live in Texas than anywhere else, because I would be appreciated. But if I were the way I actually was at that age, 31-inch waist, rather soggy complexion, and an IQ hovering near 160, Texas would not be my chosen residence. Quimper took vigorous exception to this. No state in the world pays greater deference to women than Texas. Our speaker proceeded. Texas has its own peculiar set of laws, and they stem directly from the tenets of Southern chivalry. But this also has its drawbacks. Because Texans prize freedom so highly, they refuse to burden themselves with the obligations which other less wealthy states have assumed. In public education, very tardy in establishing schools, very niggardly in paying for them. in public services, except roads, among the least generous in the nation. In health services, care for children, care for the aged, provisions for prisoners, always near the bottom. This was too much for Rusk and Quimper, who battled to see who would refute her first. Rusk won. But does not Texas stand, when all's considered, as one of the best states in the Union? And she said, unquestionably. Then Quimper asked, wouldn't you rather be working in Texas than in Carolina? And again she said, of course. Then what's this beef against chivalry? I'm proud of the way I treat women. And she said, chivalry is a man's determination of how he should treat women. It's his definition, not hers. I would like to see a somewhat juster determination of the relationship. You ain't gonna like it when you get it, Quimper warned. I got me a dear little daughter coming on 16. I would like nothing better for her than to build a good life here in Texas. Maybe a cheerleader at the university. Find herself a good man, maybe a rancher or an oil man out on the firing line. Ma'am, that's true chivalry. That's Texas. I'm willing to grant that, the speaker said, but I'm trying to make 2 points. One, the values you've just defended are essentially Southern. Two, it's easier to maintain them, Mr. Quimper, if you have 9 ranches and 19 oil wells. Il Magnifico startled our visitor by swinging the conversation around to where we had started the night before. Did you know, Dr. Frobisher, that our boy here, Travis Barlow, is being denied a major job up north because he's Texas? Because he ain't from Harvard or Chicago? I find that difficult to believe. It's true. It's what we Texans have to fight against. And much of the stigma comes from the fact that, like you said, we adopted all those Southern rules and customs. I suppose that's right, she said. I sometimes see the next 50 years as a protracted effort by the South to re-establish its leadership of the nation. We Carolinians and Virginians aren't powerful enough to do it by ourselves, so we're going to use Texas as our stalking horse. With your strength, your duplicity, we have a chance of winning. Ma'am, Quimper said, you've made a heap of sense this morning. You did us great honor in coming here to share your views with us. He was growing more Southern by the minute. I'll tell you something, she said to all of us as she gathered her papers. I stay here at TCU because I love Texas. I've been invited back to 4 different schools in Carolina and Georgia. Sometimes I long for that easier life, that civilized custom. But I stay here for one good reason. I want to be where the action is. I love the skyline of Fort Worth, the noise, the vitality, the wheeling and dealing, the expensive shops, the good restaurants. Rusk interrupted this song of praise with a blunt question which any of us might have asked. Are you classifying Texas as a southern state? Definitely not. It has none of the basic characteristics of Mississippi or Virginia. It's southwestern? No, it lacks the qualities of Arizona and New Mexico. What is it, then? Unique. Jamming her papers into her briefcase, she smiled. When you reach the age of 47, if you have any brains, you awaken to the fact that the race is going to be over much sooner than you thought. So, if I have only one life to live, only one dent to make, I want to make it where it counts. In Texas. Chapter 10. The Fort. When Ulysses Grant, one of the bloodiest generals in United States history, assumed the presidency in 1869, his fellow officers serving in the West were jubilant. Now we can settle with the Indians once and for all, and they made preparations to do so. To their astonishment, Grant initiated a thoughtful, humane, and revolutionary peace policy, which he believed would lure the warring Indians into some kind of harmonious relationship with the white settlers who were increasingly invading their plains. His proposal had several major aspects. Instead of allowing the army to govern Indian affairs, the churches of America would be invited to nominate from their congregations men of goodwill who would move west to the reservations, where they would be in control. Their task would be to win Indian allegiance by kindness, by distributing free food, and by setting an example of Christian brotherhood. Funds would be provided from the National Treasury to support the new plans. In return, all Indians would be expected to live peacefully on reservations, where they would be taught agriculture and where their children would attend schools that would Christianize them and teach them to wear respectable clothes instead of deerskin and feathers. When Captain Hermann Wetzel, a veteran of both the Prussian Army and the Civil War, and now serving with the 14th Infantry on occupation duty in Texas, read the new orders, he threw them on the table. The General Grant I knew never signed such garbage. An opinion shared by most of the Army, which saw its freedom to act diminished and its prerogatives shaved. Like Wetzel, many officers were determined to sabotage what they considered General Grant's misguided order. The religious group most eager to supply civilian personnel for the new system was the one whose principles were most antithetical to Army methods, the Quakers of Pennsylvania, one of whose major tenets was pacifism. In this Indian challenge, they saw an opportunity to prove that friendly persuasion produced better results than military force. Indeed, they called themselves Friends, and their church the Society of Friends. They were a small group, concentrated mainly in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but they had gained notoriety throughout the South for their vigorous opposition to slavery. Loyal Texans like Reuben Cobb and Yancey Quimper had characterized the Quakers as damned fools and troublemakers, a view generally held throughout the state. For those who had fought against the Indians, especially against the Apache and Comanche, could not imagine how the peace-loving Quakers intended handling them. "It's going to be a shambles when Comanche, like Chief Muttark, go up against them Bible-pushers." One of the first men to be considered for this challenging task was a young farmer from the tiny village of Buckingham in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. His place of residence reminded people of George Fox, the founder of Quakerism, who had had powerful associations with Buckinghamshire in England. "Earnshaw's a fine Quaker," they said of him. So when the letter from President Grant arrived, asking the local Quakers to nominate men qualified for this critical new assignment, the elders naturally thought of Earnshaw Rusk, 27 years old and unmarried. "It's as if he were designated by God to carry on the good works of our founder, the saintly Fox." Without alerting Rusk, they sent his name forward. Rusk gave the impression of being saintly, for he was tall, very thin, diffident in manner and rumpled in appearance, with the detached behavior of some minor Old Testament holy man. Even as a young boy, he had seemed gawky and apart, his trousers ending 8 inches above his shoe tops, his sleeves 7 inches from his wrists. His piety evidenced itself before he was 19, when in meeting he was constrained to lecture his elders about what was proper in human behavior. And at 20, he ventured behind Confederate lines in Virginia and North Carolina, seeking to arouse the slaves in those states to demand their freedom. His innocence had protected him, for he had bumbled into 3 or 4 really perilous situations, only to find miraculous rescue. Once, south of Richmond, a black family whose members thought him quite irresponsible had hidden him in a cotton gin when a posse came searching for him. And in North Carolina, a woman who owned slaves lied to the searchers about to arrest him, then told him when they were gone, "Go home, young man. You're making a fool of yourself." But in the summer of 1865, when everything he had preached had come to pass, he returned to those slaves who had saved his life and to the good woman in Carolina, bringing them food and money contributed by the Philadelphia Quakers. And he had prayed with both the blacks and the whites, assuring them that God had ordained that they save him in 1862, so that he could return now to help them get started in a better life. The Carolina woman, whose farm had been burned by Sherman's rioting men, warned him once more that he was making a fool of himself. But after he had stayed with her for 3 weeks, helping to clear away the ruins and make space for a new home, she concluded, "Rusk, you're a living saint, but you're not long for this world." The officials appointed by President Grant to receive nominations for the new posts were delighted to hear of a man who seemed to fill every requirement. He's vigorous, he has no wife to cause complications and expense, and he will love the Indians as he loved the slaves. There was a dissenting vote, for an older man who had made his living in Philadelphia commerce a harsh testing ground, feared that anyone as naive as the recommendations showed Earnshaw Rusk to be was bound to have trouble translating his piety into positive action. "I'm afraid that if we throw this young fellow into a place like Texas, they'll eat him alive." "He won't be going to Texas," a member of the committee explained. "He's ticketed for a location in the Indian Territory." But the other man warned, "That's pretty close to Texas." The committee, eager to announce its first appointment, overrode the businessman's objection and informed President Grant that Earnshaw Rusk, well-respected Quaker farmer of Buckingham, Pennsylvania, unmarried and in good health, is recommended for the position of United States Indian Agent at Camp Hope on the north bank of the Red River in the Indian Territory. Grant, also quite eager to get his program started, accepted the recommendation. "We've found the perfect man to tame the Comanche." Earnshaw was plowing his fields when a local newspaper man came running to him. "Rusk, President Grant has appointed you to a major position in the government." Unprepared for such news, Earnshaw asked to see verification, then stood, with the telegram in his left hand, reins in his right, and looked to heaven. "Thee has chosen me for a noble task. Help me to discharge it according to thy will." But the reporter broke in, "Says in the telegram that General Grant did the choosing." When confirmation reached Buckingham, Rusk felt inspired to address his final first-day meeting. "I must demonstrate to the Army and to the nation as a whole that our policy of peace and understanding brotherhood is God's elected way for bringing the savage Indian into productive partnership. I deem it my duty to work among the Indians as I worked among the slaves, and I am satisfied the results will be the same." If William Penn could bring peace to his Indians, "I feel certain I can do the same with the Apache and the Comanche. I seek your prayers." A cynical Quaker businessman who had traveled in Texas whispered to the man next to him, "William Penn would have lasted 10 minutes with the Comanche." As Rusk spoke his hopeful words in eastern Pennsylvania, the rambling family of Joshua Larkin was preparing to establish rude quarters on a site Larkin had scouted about 60 miles west of the newly established town of Jacksboro, Texas. Army officials stationed at nearby Fort Richardson warned the Larkins as they arrived that they ran serious risks if they ventured so far west, and Captain George Reed, a gloomy man, was downright rude. "Damn it, Larkin, if you stick your neck way out there, how can we protect you?" "Six times in Texas we've moved west, always to better land. And 6 times we heard the same warning. The Waco will get you, the Kiowa will get you, and now you're saying the Comanche'll get you." Larkin, whose lined face seemed a map of the frontier lands he had conquered, poked Reed in the arm. "We ain't never been as afraid as the Army." "And you ain't never battled the Indians the way the Army has," Reed snapped, imitating Larkin's raspy whine. "That's because we're smarter'n the Indians, and you ain't." "You're from Alabama, aren't you?"
"Sure am."
"I learned 20 years ago you can never teach an Alabama man anything."
"That's why we conquered the world."
"Up to a point," Reed said, indicating his blue military sleeve. "You had the big factories, the railroads," Larkin said without rancor, as he prepared his wagons for the final push. "Any time we start even, we'll whip you Yankees easy." "Why you so eager to move west?" an older officer asked. And Joshua replied, "There's 2 kinds of Americans in this world, them as looks east and them as looks west."
"Meaning?"
"East men look for stores and banks and railroads. They have dollars in their eyes. Us west men look for untamed rivers, deep woods, open prairies. In our eyes we have the sunset, and we'll keep going till we stand with our feet in the Pacific, looking at that sunset."
"Aren't you afraid of Indians?" the officer asked. And Joshua replied, "We Larkins been fighting Redskins 50 years. No reason to stop now." But as soon as he had uttered this boast, he added, "As for me, I never killed an Indian, never proposed to." Next morning, the 16 pioneers departed. Joshua, his 2 married brothers, the 3 wives, an unmarried brother Absalom, and 9 children of all ages. "There they go," a soldier shouted as the wheels began to turn. "Israelites pouring into the land of Canaan." They would head slightly northwest along almost unbroken trails until they intersected the Brazos River, the aorta of Texas, coming at them from the left. "And when we go along it a bit, we come to Bear Creek, joining from the north. Prettiest little creek you ever saw, and where they touch, that's where we'll call home." It was a 60-mile journey, and since experience enabled them to make 15 miles a day, they planned to reach their new home at the end of the 4th day. Joshua kept his brother Absalom riding ahead as scout, and repeatedly the latter galloped back to assure the wagons that on the next rise they would see wonders. And they did. The great opening plains of West Texas, those endless, rimless horizons of waving grass and sky. Rarely did they see a tree, not too often a real hill, and never growing things on which to subsist. Through various devices, the Larkins had obtained title to about 6,000 acres of this vast expanse, at a cost of 4 cents an acre, and they realized that it was no bargain, but it did have, as Joshua had reported after his scout, 4 advantages. Cattle unlimited, wild horses for the ropin', constant water, an open range for as far as a man can throw his eye. There was excitement when Absalom rode back to inform his relatives, "Brazos River ahead, 1 more day's travel." He was correct in his guess, and when the Larkins started their trip along its northern bank, they felt as if they were once more safe. When they reached the confluence with Bear Creek, they stopped on a small rise and surveyed their promised land. "Ain't nothing here but what we're going to build, all ours." They had brought with them a few domesticated cattle, a string of good horses, and 6 wagons containing a bewildering mixture of whatever goods they had been able to amass. Cloth and medicines, nails and hammers, plus the lumber on which to use them, spare axles and wheels, a few pots, a few forks, and 2 Bibles. The Larkins were Baptists, Democrats, veterans of the Confederate Army, excellent shots, and afraid of nothing. The 3 wives came from 3 different religions, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, but all knew the sacred harp, that twangy religious music of the South. And now, as they prepared to pitch their tents for the first time at their new home, they united in song. Their 9 children joined in, and when the lilting hymn ended, Joshua cried, "Lord, we made it. The rest is in your hands." To the 3 sod houses they were about to build, they brought an arsenal of firearms. Sharps, Colts, Enfields, Hawkins, Springfields. And each child above the age of 5 was trained in their use. They did not anticipate trouble, since, as Joshua had boasted to Reed, they had edged their way 5 previous times into lands recently held by Indians and had invariably found ways to neutralize the savages, principally by trading with them, giving them a fair exchange. Of course, when Texas Indian policy had become expulsion or extermination, their bold forebears had helped in the former and applauded the latter. But this generation, probing into a more dangerous section of the state and up against a more dangerous type of Indian, hoped for peace. They spent 2 days of hectic action gouging a large sod dugout in which all would sleep at first. And then Joshua turned to the second preoccupation of all Texans. "The land is ours, the water we got to collect." And he put all the men and boys, even the tiny lads, to the task of throwing across a gully a rude dam which would impound enough water to form what Alabamans called a pond, but Texans a tank. "With a good tank," Joshua said, "we can manage cattle and horses. But now we got to get ourselves some ready cash." And he divided his workforce into 2 groups,
one to rope wild horses and bring in stray cattle that could be sold in Jacksboro, the other to go out onto the plains with their powerful Sharps rifles to kill buffalo. They would be skinned, with the aid of horses that pulled loose the hairy hides, and dragged them back to where they could be baled for shipment to markets in the east. The carcasses, of course, they left to rot. It was miserable work, and as the buffalo began to withdraw westward, travel to the killing grounds became more onerous. But always Joshua spurred his brothers. Get horses, get cattle, kill the buffalo. His strategy was not accidental, for if the Larkins could assemble horses and cattle, they would possess the basis for a prosperous ranch. And if they could exterminate the buffalo, they would make the plains uninhabitable for the Indians. The Larkin brothers did not want to kill off the Comanche. They wanted to ease them onto reservations north of the Red River, leaving Texas as it was intended to be, freed of Indians. Give us 3 years of peace, Joshua said at the end of one vigorous stretch, and bring soldiers 50 miles west to a new chain of forts, we'll have this land pacified. He never said that Bear Creek would be their permanent home, for he and one of his brothers had already scouted more than 200 miles west, to where green canyons dug deep in the earth, with plenty of water and even some trees. Given time and persistence, the Larkins were going to own those canyons. The particular tribe of Comanche, led by Chief Matark, a 40-year-old veteran of the Plains Wars, had for many generations occupied the rolling areas west of Bear Creek, and from this sanctuary had ranged 200 miles north into Oklahoma lands and 500 miles south into Mexico. They had ravaged competing tribes of Indians and plundered white settlements, including El Paso and Saltillo. Whole decades would pass without a major defeat, for under Matark's strategies, the Comanche eluded pursuit by the army, avoided pitched battles, and struck whenever a position stood exposed. They were cruel and crafty enemies, well able to defend themselves, and remorseless when an isolated ranch seemed unprotected. In the autumn of 1868, the bold appearance of the Larkin clan at the confluence of Bear Creek and the Brazos troubled Chief Matark so much that he did an unusual thing. He convened a war council. It was unusual, because customarily he made all military decisions himself. How many are they? 4 grown men, all good with the rifle. 3 wives who can also shoot. 9 children, some old enough to use guns. How do they dare move on to our land? They expect the fort they call Richardson to protect them. How far are they from the fort? Their huts stand 3 days' walk to the west. 3 days? The chief cried. In that time we could wipe them out. But then he grew cautious. Could they have an arrangement with the soldiers there? Detachments hiding in the gullies, waiting for us to attack? No soldier has visited the 3 sod huts, never. But could there be a secret, something we can't see? There is no secret. If we strike now, as we should, the army cannot reach us in 2 days. Matark, not wholly satisfied with the reports of his younger braves, sought counsel from 2 old men who had seen many battles, and the older of the two, a man with no teeth who stayed alive by willpower, said, "It is not the army. It is not how many guns they have in the 3 sod houses. What will destroy us is the way they kill our buffalo." Said the second old man, "With each moon, the animals move farther away, and fewer of them. If they stay at Bear Creek, and if more come as they always do, what shall we do?" "Now there we face trouble," the first old man said. "If we could only pray that the fort at Jacksboro would be the last." "Always they push the forts closer," his associate pointed out. "That's how it always has been. That's how it always will be." "Until we are pushed where?" Matark cried, in what was for him close to desperation. The 2 old men looked at each other, well aware of what must be spoken, but each afraid to utter the doleful words. Finally, the older spoke. "We shall be pushed to the sunset death." "But not quickly," Matark said, betraying the tragic strategy he intended following. "No," the younger of the two sages cried, happy to hear the courage in his chieftain's voice. "It will be like the old days, when every hand was raised against us. Kiowa, Apache, Mexican, Texan. We shall strike them all." With these fighting words, recreating the bravery the Comanche had displayed against all enemies, a grand euphoria filled the air, and imaginary arrows whistled around the conspirators. The Comanche would strike again. They would strike again and again. They would battle the entire blue-clad army. They would protect their range. They would expel invaders now and forever. "We will destroy them," Matarque decreed. And with a mixture of fear and joy, the old man ran out to reveal the decision to the braves. They knew that, judged by the long years, this strategy must fail, but they also knew that it was a gesture which had to be made. The odds against them were tremendous, for they knew how few in number they were and how powerful that line of Texas forts could be, crammed with blue-clad soldiers. The Comanche could recite the fearful names: Fort Richardson in the north, the new Fort Griffin, Fort McCabot, Fort Concho, where the many rivers met, Fort Stockton to the west, Fort Davis, strongest of all beneath the mountains, Fort Bliss at the Rio Grande, and a dozen more. There were also forts in New Mexico, in Arizona, and California, so placed that cavalry troops could strike at Indians from any direction. The old men knew they were doomed, but they also knew that they had no alternative but to defend their rolling plains as they had always defended them. And they were proud that a young chief whom they had helped train was willing to assume the burden. So they moved among the warriors, crying, "It's to be war," and they kept their voices strong to mask their fears. 119 Comanche braves left their camp at the headwaters of the Brazos River and rode in three separate groups, quietly and with sullen determination, toward Bear Creek. And on the morning of the third day, just after dawn on the 15th of October, 1869, they came thundering down upon three sod huts. Catching Absalom as he tended his horses, they tomahawked him immediately and made off with about half the animals. They then struck the westernmost of the huts before the occupants could organize its defense, and with total superiority overwhelmed it, killing the wife and her two children, but saving the husband for ritual tortures. With the second house, they ran into real trouble, for here Michael Larkin and his wife were ready with a full arsenal, with which they held off the attackers for more than an hour. In the end, the defenders were helpless. The Indians rode their horses right up to the walls and fired into the openings. Again, the wife was killed with her child, but the man was spared for attention later. At the somewhat larger home of Joshua Larkin, the defense was formidable, with father, mother, and two children firing guns with deadly result. Nine Indians died while circling this house, until finally Matarque himself had to lead a charge which set fire to the grass roof, forcing the occupants out. When Joshua appeared, he was slain instantly, but the wife was captured alive. Of the six children in the hut, three were killed with tomahawk blows to the head, two were lanced, and the girl Emma Larkin, 12 years old, was taken alive to serve as a plaything for the younger braves. Because the nature of Indian warfare on the Texas range must be understood if the history of Texas is to be appreciated, it must be recorded that during a span of about 30 years, dozens of farmers and ranchers and traders were killed each year by the Indians, an awesome total. But it was the manner in which they were killed that enraged the settlers and made any peace with the Indians impossible. At Bear Creek, two of the youngest children were grabbed by the heels and bashed against rocks. Three were hatcheted, and three were lanced. Absalom and a brother were tomahawked in what might have been called fair fight, and two of the wives were also slain in the heat of battle. But even the bodies of these four were sought after the slaughter and ceremoniously mutilated, appendages being cut off and sexual organs defiled in savage and repulsive ways. It was the four living prisoners, three adults and a young girl, who suffered the real terrors of Indian warfare. because the two men were staked out in the embers of their burned homes, and living coals were edged about them, while their extremities were painfully hacked off. Their genitals were amputated, dragged across eyes from which the lids had been cut away, and then stuffed into their mouths. Their eyes were then blinded, and slowly they were roasted to death. The third wife was saved till last, and even the official reports of the massacre, compiled by Captain Reed from Jacksboro, refrained from spelling out in detail what she had suffered, for it was too horrible for him to write. Not one of the 15 dead bodies was left whole. Heads were cut off, arms and legs were chopped into pieces, breasts were severed, eyes were gouged out, and not even torsos were entire. From the evidence I saw, I must conclude that four adults were burned alive after the most terrible tortures. I cannot imagine that a chief as wise as Matark is supposed to be can think that by such actions he can frighten away our legitimate settlers or deter our army from retaliation. When I buried the 15 bodies, I stood beside their common grave and took an oath, which I required the men at Fort Richardson to take with me when I returned last night. I will hunt down this savage killer, even though he hides at the ends of the earth. These dead shall be revenged, or I shall die in the attempt. But after the oath was taken, a soldier who had kept records of settlers passing through reminded us that the Larkin family had consisted of 16 members, which meant that one must still be alive. And with the help of my men who assisted at the burial, we reconstructed the family, and concluded that a girl named Emma, about 12 years old, was not among the dead. She must be with them, and with God's help, we shall win her back. As he forwarded his report to department headquarters in San Antonio, which in turn would send it along to divisional offices in Chicago, the girl Emma was indeed alive. She was in a camp out toward the canyons, where she had already been raped repeatedly by young braves, and where jealous women and sportive young men had begun the slow, playful process of burning off her ears and her nose. The orders initiated by four-star General William Tecumseh Sherman in Washington for Captain George Reed, Company T, 14th Infantry at Fort Richardson near Jacksboro, Texas, were concise. You will proceed immediately to the spot where Bear Creek joins the Brazos and there establish a fort of the type common in Texas and the Indian Territory. You will take with you two companies of the 14th Infantry and two from the 10th Cavalry, plus such supporting cadre as may be required, not to exceed the authorized complement of 12 officers, 58 non-commissioned officers, and 220 privates, 8 musicians, and 14 auxiliary personnel. Total 312. The fort is to be named, with appropriate ceremony, in honor of the Texas Ranger captain who distinguished himself so heroically at Monterey, Sam Garner. Your mission is to protect American settlers, to establish working relations with the Indian reservation at Camp Hope in the Indian Territory, and to capture and punish Chief Matark of the Comanche if he strays into Texas. At the end of October 1869, Captain Reed, 33 years old, crop-headed, clean-shaven, underweight, and the owner of an unblemished military record, led his contingent west. Symbolic of the condition in which he would find himself during the next 3 decades of his command, his paper allotment of 312 effectives was 66 short, including a Lieutenant Renfro, whose energetic and conniving wife Daisy had succeeded in gaining him a third extension of his temporary desk assignment in Washington. Since the conclusion of the Civil War, Renfro had avoided any frontier duty and seemed on his way to avoiding this stint as well. Several aspects of Fort Sam Garner were noteworthy. First, it was not a fort in the accepted sense of that romantic word, for it boasted no encircling walls and provided no secure defense against an enemy. It was instead a collection of some 24 buildings laid out neatly on a large expanse of open ground. Second, the buildings were not of stone or brick, but of timber, adobe, fieldstone, or whatever else might be at hand. Third, even these miserable accommodations were not in existence when the 246 effectives arrived on the scene. The enlisted men would have to erect them in haphazard fashion as time passed. Until then, the men would live in tents, and since winter was approaching, the men worked diligently
requiring little urging from their officers. Because until houses of some sort were slapped together, they were going to freeze at night, regardless of how much they sweated during the day. Fourth, when General Sherman assigned two companies of the 10th Cavalry to the fort, he knew that he was creating permanent trouble for Captain Reed, because the 10th Cavalry was an all-Negro regiment, which meant it would generate not only the customary animosity which existed between foot and horse soldiers, but also the more serious viciousness stemming from the difference in color. One aspect of the typical Texas fort in 1869 would have surprised the northern troops who built it had they known the facts. Their wall-less, adobe, unfortified assembly of buildings resembled strikingly the old presidio which the Spanish military had erected in San Antonio a century and a half earlier. Like sensible men, the Spanish and the American soldiers reacted almost identically to similar geographical and logistical problems. But the outstanding characteristic of the fort was the nature of its officer cadre, as revealed by the roster. Officer Reed George, born 1836, wife Louise, natal state Vermont, duty Company T, 14th Infantry, Fort Commander, permanent official rank today, Captain. Temporary brevet rank during Civil War, Brigadier General. Minor Johnny, born 1839, wife Nellie, natal state Wisconsin, Company R, 10th Cavalry, Senior Cavalry Officer, permanent official rank today, Captain. Temporary brevet rank during Civil War, Colonel. Wetzel Hermann, born 1829, wife Bertha, natal state Germany. Company U, 14th Infantry, Senior Infantry Officer. Permanent rank, Captain. Brevet rank, Colonel. Sanders Tom, born 1840. Wife, Ruth. Natal state, Maine. Company T, 14th Infantry, Adjutant. Permanent rank, First Lieutenant. Temporary brevet rank, Captain. Harrison Tom, born 1843. Natal state, Iowa. Company S, 10th Cavalry. Permanent rank today, First Lieutenant. Temporary brevet rank, Lieutenant Colonel. Logan Jim, born 1844, natal state, Ireland. Company S, 10th Cavalry. Rank today, Second Lieutenant. Brevet rank, Major. Masters Andrew, born 1845, natal state, Illinois. Company U, 14th Infantry. Permanent rank, Second Lieutenant. Brevet rank, Captain. Toomey Elmer, born 1849, natal state, Indiana. Company R, 10th Cavalry. Permanent official rank, 2nd Lieutenant. Renfro Lewis, born 1838, wife, Daisy, natal state, Ohio. Company S, 10th Cavalry, detached duty, Washington. Permanent rank, 1st Lieutenant, brevet rank, Colonel. Jaxifer John, born 1827, natal state, Georgia. Company R, 10th Cavalry, 1st Sergeant. Permanent official rank today, 1st Sergeant. Temporary brevet rank during Civil War, 1st Sergeant. One interesting thing to be noted was that none of the officers, and only an occasional black enlisted man, came from the South, because that region had recently been in rebellion, with even its West Point sons like Generals Lee and Davis rejecting their oath to defend the Union. You can't never trust no Southerin, and we won't tolerate him in our army. Of the many forts that would protect Texas in these years, none would be manned by Texans. The presence of a German and an Irishman at Fort Garner was not unusual. Thousands of such volunteers had served in the Union forces, usually with distinction, and not infrequently it was these European veterans who formed the backbone of the frontier army. They were belligerent, sticklers for proper drill, and dependable. In Hermann Wetzel and Jim Logan, Fort Garner had two of the best. The former, a Prussian disciplinarian in charge of all foot soldiers, the latter, a daring, laughing horseman who worked with the black troops. It was the last column of the roster that showed the heartache of a peacetime fort, because, as can be seen, all the officers except Lieutenant Toomey had enjoyed, during the Great War, a brevet or temporary rank considerably higher than what they now held. A brevet promotion could have been conferred in one of many ways. A new regiment would be formed, requiring colonels and majors, so officers much lower in rank would be temporarily promoted to meet the emergency,
it being understood that when peace came, they would revert to their lower rank. A senior officer would be killed in battle, and a replacement would be breveted. Often in the heat of battle, some extremely brave lieutenant would be breveted to colonel, and he would be addressed as colonel and treated like one, but his real rank would remain lieutenant. Now it was peacetime, and military personnel was savagely reduced. 1,516 men in 1865, 37,313 now. And even the slowest-witted officer could foresee that he was going to remain in his lowered permanent rank for years and years. During the war, an able soldier like Reed had almost leaped from second lieutenant to brigadier general, six promotions in heady sequence. He, George Reed, a schoolteacher from Vermont, had actually been a general in charge of a flank attack on Petersburg, and now he was a lowly captain, four demotions downward, with every expectation of remaining indefinitely at that level. During the war, the leap from lieutenant to major had required, in his case, 5 months, for attrition had been great. In peacetime, the slow crawl back to major would require at least a quarter of a century, if it was ever attained. Yet all except young Elmer Toomey could remember when they had been officers of distinguished rank. Johnny Minor had been a full colonel, and a good one. But now, and for as long as he could see into the future, he would be a captain in charge of one company of black troops, and he could not reasonably anticipate higher promotion, not ever. White officers who served with black troops were contaminated and scorned by their fellow officers. To such men, few promotions fell. However, within the security of these remote forts, it was customary, when speaking directly to an officer, to award him the highest rank he had held as brevet. So, although the adjutant, when reporting in writing to Washington, had to write, "Captain Reed, commanding officer, Fort Garner, wishes to inform," when that same adjutant addressed Reed within the fort, he would say, "General Reed, I wish to report." It was a delicate game, where sensitivities were constantly exposed, and where imagined insults rankled for years. And nowhere was it played out with richer variation than on the vast expanses of Texas. Actual duels were forbidden, but they sometimes occurred. What was more likely, some disgruntled first lieutenant who had once been a lieutenant colonel would nurture in secret a grudge against a lieutenant who had been only a brevet major, and on some hate-filled day would find an excuse to bring court-martial charges against him. This then became an affair of honor, dragging on year after year. Often each officer would publish a small book, giving his true account of what transpired at Richard's Crossing, proving that it was his accuser, not he, who had been craven. This was Fort Garner in 1869, a collection of makeshift and undistinguished buildings, but each laid out with that compass-point precision which would have prevailed had they been built of marble. Reed had insisted on this, and during the planning he had appeared everywhere with his chalk line, squaring walls and ensuring that buildings of the same character stood in orderly array. It may be an unholy mess now, but it won't always be. After consultation with Wetzel, who had a keen sense of tactics, he had decided that the fort would be built east of Bear Creek, so that any Indians coming at it from the west would have to attack across that stream or across the Brazos. To safeguard against flooding, he had his men spend 2 weeks deepening each stream, and then he strengthened the mud dam with which the Larkins had constructed their tank. Fort Garner would stand 58 miles west of Jacksboro, same distance south of Camp Hope in the Indian Territory. The five officers' buildings, each with detached kitchen and privy, would form the eastern boundary of the long parade ground, the enlisted men's quarters the western. The northern limit was hemmed in by the service buildings, while the southern was defined by the hospital and the store, run by the post sutler. As if to give protection from the west, where the enemy roamed, the stables were located there as a kind of bulwark, north of which stood one of the curiosities of the western fort, Sud's Row, where the hired laundresses, sometimes Mexican, sometimes reformed prostitutes, but most often the wives of enlisted men, washed uniforms 6 days a week. When the men of Fort Garner were at their home station, they were a natty lot, especially the Buffalo Soldiers, as the blacks were called, because their knotted hair was supposed to resemble that of the buffalo. Buffalo Soldier, originally a term of opprobrium, had been adopted by the black cavalrymen as a designation of honor, and one fact about Fort Garner summarized that situation. The effective complement had begun at 246, but because of desertion, conniving to escape difficult duty, and slow recruitment, it would become only 232. But of the 134 black horsemen assigned to Fort Garner, only two would desert over a period of 3 years. Of the white infantrymen, 14 had already gone by the end of the first 4 months. To be a Buffalo Soldier was a sterling attainment. Many of these men had entered Union service in the darkest days of the war, and they had served heroically, fighting both the avowed enemy at the south and the insidious one at the north. From the beginning, they had known they were not liked and were not wanted, and during peace, this dislike was hammered home in 100 mean and malicious ways. For example, the parade ground at Fort Garner had been in operation less than a week when Wetzel came to Reed with a serious complaint. "General, when the troops line up at morning and evening review, the Buffalo Soldiers, as is proper, stand at the south before their stables. Could you direct Colonel Minor to keep his niggers well removed from my men? We cannot tolerate the smell." When Reed broached the subject to Minor, the Wisconsin man showed no animosity, nor did his cavalryman, when he jokingly asked them to muster, "just a wee bit to the south, so we don't offend anyone." The cavalrymen knew how desperately they were appreciated when at the height of some offensive against the Indians. They appeared at the critical moment to support infantry units pinned down by Indian fire. "We was there when you needed us, and we'll be there next time, too." It was unpleasant sometimes, being a Buffalo Soldier, but the work provided moments of great satisfaction, and it was for these that the black troops drilled so strenuously and served with such resilient humor.